haven't all lived in one of those ghettos, you know, that like we have down in the Hillcrest area in Dallas, you know, where all the poor people live, all the Jews. And in this ghetto, they have a high school called Hillcrest High School. And Leventhal told me that one time down there, he was going by the school, and up on the bulletin board, they have a little sign that says, you know, there weren't very many Gentiles, and it said, there'll be a meeting of the Gentiles in the phone booth after school. So that will kind of give you a background on Leventhal. He's quite a character. You really enjoy him if you go to this conference. Tonight, they asked me to come up here and speak on evolution. Let me move this baby over here. We'll cover up the pledges on the bottom there. And I wanted to preface it a little bit. The reason I'm not an evolutionist. However, when I was at MIT and since then, I was a very strong evolutionist, and I've had to change my position. And this is what I kind of want to present tonight, why I don't think evolution is true. I'm not going to give you a position. I've come to trust this Bible more and more just because I've studied the history, the historical background more and more, gone through all these ancient records, and have come to have quite a confidence in it. But I'm not going to say that the Bible's true. I'm not going to say anything like this. I want to present why it is physically impossible. I can believe the Bible and believe evolution too, except for one thing, physics. So tonight, don't think I'm going to say, well, the Bible's true, and, you know, cram it down your throat. I just want to present why, according to physics, it's physically impossible to have evolution. Now, that's going to grind you at first, but I think if you stick with me, you got to teach a little bit of physics. Some of these girls aren't exactly physically inclined, except in certain ways. I'm supposed to be a mechanical engineer and can't get the chalk. What you have in studying, there are two things that really fascinate people. One of them is the origin of the earth and the universe, and the other one is the origin of life that took place in the system. What you have over here is you have evidence, such as fossils, geological layers, you name it, we got it down here. This is in the physical world. Okay, everything around us, we got this stuff. Now what we try and do is correlate this into a system. So we postulate some theories. Okay? And the three basic theories that try and explain both the origin of the universe and the origin of life. And let me just list these. One of them is evolution. There are two types of this. One of them is natural. The second one is theistic. By this I mean natural. There's no such thing as a God. It's all just by chance. Boom, 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 takes place. Second one. Now, I'm not sure how I'm going to put this. This should be, let's say, uniformitarian. It's slowly evolving processes. This, the next form is kata. I'm going to write it in. Catastrophism. Now, this is where things, big and gigantic events took place. Boom, 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 boom. It's not a slowly progressing process. The chief opponent proponent of this is a fellow by the name of Velikovsky. And I don't want to, you don't want to pass this one by too lightly. Einstein thought this guy was right. And there's two forms of this, natural, and I'll show you the difference between these in a minute, and theistic. Okay? And then you have one last theory, and that's the creationist. Now, what I'm going to strike at tonight are these two, basically. Natural catastrophism and natural evolution or uniformitarianism, this slow process. Now, I'm going to attack these two. Now, this isn't going to eliminate this one, or this last one. But this is the one that everyone holds to, natural evolution, practically. And this is what I'm going to go to. And the reason is, the way we're going to do this, is there are certain laws that you have that govern every type of interaction of mass and energy. And there are two basic laws to this. The first and second laws of thermodynamics. These are the two most basic laws of physics. Every law is subordinate to these. The law of gravity, you name it, it's subordinate to these two laws. And this is what we're going to do. Now, some people will say, well, biological systems don't have to obey physical laws. That's stupid. Biology can be reduced to chemistry, which is chemical interactions. Unless, of course, you believe that in vitalism, that there's something spiritual in matter that guides it, which is unscientific. Okay, and then chemistry, in turn, reduces to physics. It's just the chemistry is, when you get to understanding it very clearly, is just mass and energy transformations, etc., controlled by these laws. So everything's controlled. Now, what happens is these theories have to fall under the auspices of these laws. There's a hierarchy. Laws are the things that we found in every case to be true. Theories are things that are postulated and haven't been tried yet, or we don't have enough evidence to change them over to a law. Okay, now, for instance, evolution is not a law. It's far from it. It's a theory. Catastrophism is a theory. Now, we're going to go into these laws, and this is where the heart of the thing lies. If anything we know in all of history is true, then these two laws are. And do we have something to race this board with? Oh, wait a minute, I've got to clean this. I come prepared. Okay, so you got that down, the evidence. We postulate theories how to get it. These fall under the auspices of certain laws, okay? Okay, now these two basic laws are what we call the first and second laws of thermodynamics. They're fairly simple. And first law is just conservation of energy and mass. Girls sometimes have a... This has to do with... We'll get across. Okay, now you girls, here's a good way of illustrating this. In nature, you have energy changing pockets all the time. From one pocket to another. It goes from mechanical to heat to electrical to, you know, you name it, fluid. It's just always changing pockets. You don't gain or lose anything in the process. And in fact, Einstein shows that mass is just another form of energy. So the sum of these two are, you know the equation, E equals mc squared. That just shows the mass is another form of energy. Like in the atomic bomb, some mass suddenly disappears and you got it concentrated in an area about that big. And there's so much of it, it's got to go someplace. It does everything to get out of that small area that it can. You've just got a lot of energy. But the sum of the two is not constant. When mass disappears, energy always appears in its place. And theoretically, if we could get enough energy concentrated, we could get mass out of it again. But let's get back to these girls. To explain this, baby. Okay, now suppose you're going to, most of you will probably get married one day. You have a husband. When you're married, right? Suppose he has $10, okay, in his pocket. Goes out, earns another 10, not very wealthy. Earns another 10, not a very good job, I should say. Okay, you come along and yank out 20. Okay? The sum of money is the same, it's just changed pockets. And that's the way it is in nature. Things just change pockets. You don't come up with more or less. It's always the same. Okay? Things just don't disappear. You know, one guy with Campus Crusade, his name's Andre Cole. He happened to be the world's best magician at one time. He performed for the Magicians Convention. And up on the stage for him, he'd make a Volkswagen disappear off that stage. Now, he wasn't violating this law here, the conservation of energy and mass. He's just an illusionist. He plays the game. That car was someplace. It just wasn't where you thought it was. But nature isn't like that. Sometimes it appears that way, but it's always there. It's just hidden in another way. Okay? If we plot this in time, say we... Man, this chalk's tough. Okay, on a time basis, and suppose we took energy, all the energy in this room, okay? A lot of bodies in here, a lot of energy. Okay, we divide the energy in this room by the volume of the room, okay? And all we get is an energy density, okay? You have the same thing with mass. You take the volume, the mass that's in there, the weight of it, and divide it by the volume. That's mass density. So we're just going to use energy density. Okay, and this is the average energy. Now, let's include in this energy this mass term, density. And this is just constant for time. And what that says is just, if this room loses some energy, it goes into the next one, and the average is the same when you sum it over the whole universe. Okay? It's just conserved. It's nothing's gained or lost. That's all the same. And for all time, this is constant. Okay, the second law. Now that we lost you on that one. This essentially has to do with the quantity. If I don't spell something right, you have to excuse me. I just work in numbers and, you know, terrible at English. You should have seen my college boards. Okay, this just has to do with increasing entropy. And this just has to do with the quality of energy. You have to stick with me. We're almost finished with this, and then we'll start to get into some of the implications. That's where it really becomes delightful. Okay, this has to do with the quantity. And this just says that although the total amount of energy is conserved and mass, that the useful amount of this energy, the kind we can use for work, is decreasing with time. It's becoming more and more random. It's being used up. For instance, that's one reason you have to keep putting gasoline in your car. If you put it in there, it's useful, but then it's just dissipated out into the air. Now, the energy is conserved. It's the same amount of energy you had before. It's all there. It's just random. A good little illustration of this is, suppose you take a brick, hold it out over a lake, and let it drop. Now, right before it hits that water, that thing's got a lot of useful energy. And you can tap it. You can use it to run a machine or something else. Just hook a machine on it and let it pull it up. As it slows down, it'll run a machine. However, that thing, you let it hit the water, it creates waves, and these waves go out. Finally, it sinks to the bottom, and the waves eventually die down. Now, the energy's all there. It's those molecules in the lake are vibrating a little harder than before. It's random now. But there's no way to get those random molecules to pick up that brick and kick it back up into the air. It's all there. It's random. It's not useful anymore. Okay? And so what you're doing here, let's plot this one again. Time. This just says that the average, now this is the total energy plus mass, this is the average useful energy plus mc squared, density again. See, density will handle an infinite universe. Some people say, well, suppose the universe is infinite, then you have infinite amount. Well, we're just going to work with density. Okay? So what happens here in the second law? This thing's dropping off, and here we are, sometime in the present. It's going towards zero, the amount of useful energy in the universe. Okay? That's the law, simply. Fairly, you know, just that. This just has to do with the quantity. The quantity is always constant. The quality is always decreasing, if you want to put it that way. It's becoming more and more random. Okay, let's put these things together. This is where it really becomes interesting. Okay, you got those. Let me just superimpose the second law and the first law. Okay, this is the second law. This is the first. And here's the present time. Okay? And let me explain this chart a little bit to you. You can't see it back there, can you? Can you see that all right? Okay. Not all blind. Okay, at the present time, a certain percentage of it has become unuseful. We still have some useful left. Now, there's some interesting implications that we can draw from these things. Okay, the first one. There'll be a death of the universe. And what this is saying is that the useful energy is approaching zero, and quite simply, when it does here, the universe will not be able to sustain life. There'll be no life, no light, no nothing else left in the universe. It'll be dead. I'd like to read just a quote here on this. The universe is thus progressing toward an ultimate heat death. In other words, all the energy will become random heat. Or it is technically defined a condition of maximum entropy. Entropy is increasing to the point down here that it's totally random. No energy can be used because all of it will be uniformly distributed through the cosmos. That's the universe. There will be no light, no life, no warmth, nothing but perpetual and irrevocable stagnation. Time itself will come to an end, for entropy points the direction of time. Entropy is the measure of randomness. When all system and order in the universe has vanished, and randomness is at its maximum, and entropy cannot be increased, when there is no longer any sequence of cause and effect, in short, when the universe is run down, there will be no direction to time, there will be no time. And there is no way of avoiding this destiny. For the fateful principle known as the second law of thermodynamics, which stands today as the principal pillar of classical physics left intact by the march of science, proclaims the fundamental processes of nature are irreversible. Nature moves in just one direction. The universe is dying, running out. Now, these quotes are not from people that hold my position. That's why I draw upon them. They're taken from textbooks that you can get and other sources. So I wanted to develop my position from people that don't hold it. But I want you to, we'll see why we're going to do this. Okay, so this guy says that it's going to end up. There's going to be a death to the universe. There's also one other corollary to this. It's very interesting. And I'll read this from the sheet too. But there's an important philosophical corollary to this view. For if the universe is running down and nature's processes are proceeding in just one direction, in other words, down, the inescapable inference is that everything had a beginning. Somehow, sometime, the cosmic processes were started, the stellar fires ignited, and the whole vast pageant of the universe brought into being. And here's another quote from another fellow. By the way, these are taken from a book that Einstein wrote the preface to. He thought it was the best presentation of relativity that he's seen. But the fact that the energy of the universe will be more disordered tomorrow than it is today implies. In other words, tomorrow it'll be further downhill. We'll have more chaos. It'll be more chaotic. Implies, of course, that the fact that the energy of the universe is becoming more is more highly organized today than it will be tomorrow. Today we have a more highly ordered universe. Following the process backwards, and that it was more highly organized yesterday than it was today. In other words, if we go back to yesterday, it's more highly organized. Following the process backwards, he means going this direction, tracing in time backwards, we find a more and more highly organized universe. As you go back in time, it was more and more organized back in the past. This backward tracing in time cannot be continued indefinitely. We just can't continue getting more and more order back there. Organization cannot, as it were, mount up and up without limit. There is a definite maximum. And this definite maximum must have been in existence a finite time ago. And it is impossible that this state of perfect organization could have evolved from a less perfect state. In other words, you can't have a more random state and then go up to a more organized. Nor is it possible that the universe could have persisted from eternity in that state of perfect organization and then suddenly, a finite length of time ago, begin its downward present path. In other words, he's saying it couldn't have remained up at here and then suddenly begin this downward process. And it's not possible to go up this way. Thus, the accepted laws of nature lead us to a definite beginning of the universe in time. We are to suppose, on this reasoning, that at some particular time in the past, a perfectly organized universe sprang in suddenly into being and has steadily become more and more degraded ever since. What he's saying here on this chart, as you go back here, you come to a point beyond which you can't go any further back. You cannot have more useful energy than total energy in the universe. You can't beat 100%. And so the universe cannot have existed before this point in time. It could have come into being any time after that, but it cannot have existed before that time. And it's a real serious problem. So the second implication here is a beginning. Of the universe, finite time ago. We don't have an eternal universe, in other words. So you ask the question, what does that have to do with evolution? So what? Very good. Okay, we got to get these physical laws down, and these are just two interesting sidelights. They enter into the area of cosmology, the origin of the universe. It just says it was a definite beginning. Another thing I might say about this, whatever gave it this organization had to be more complicated than any one part of the universe, which means it has to be more complicated than we are. It also has to have access to every part of it, and it has to have the ability to violate physical laws. even if it's finite, I don't care what you want to call it, God or whatever. It's more complicated than we are. It is not bound by the laws that we are. And it has to have access to every part of the universe. Draw your own conclusions from that. People don't like to accept this today, because as one fellow we're going to read says, it has serious philosophical implications. And indeed it does. It forces a person, they cannot be an atheist if they're going to believe in physics. This is a soul deal. So really it's serious. In fact, Einstein believed in a God. He was a different type of God than the Bible, but he believed in a supernatural, much greater being for the sole reason that physics forced him to. And a large number of physicists really run into this problem. They'll run up to that and they'll say, somehow it just had to happen. We don't know how it had to happen by natural deal, but there isn't any way. They have to throw away. Now, I want to stress how important these laws are. These are the very heart of our science. If we know it, these are the most absolute facts we know. Einstein modified the first law, but he just verified it again, too, in the fact that he just showed that mass wasn't conserved independently, but together with energy. Okay, let's get into evolution. There's another way of approaching the second law of thermal. Okay. What does this mean? It just means that entropy, that second law, is just equal to the log, equal to K, which is just a constant factor, times the log of the probability. And what this means is it's just the, just entropy is the measure of order of a system, the probability that that system will be in being. Like we read earlier, it says entropy is the measure of randomness. Well, that's the right way. It's also a measure of order, too, because it's the reverse of order. Okay, if something doesn't have order, it has randomness. It's chaotic. A good way of illustrating this is, for instance, in this room, we've got molecules that are all bouncing around randomly. Okay? Now, if you could get a super carburetor, there's plenty of energy here to run your car on. If you could just put a super carburetor and run that air through there, if the second law were true, you could run that air through there and just extract the energy from the air, and then the thing would just run forever on air. You take it in at a high temperature and pump it out at a lower temperature and it'd run fine. But it doesn't work quite that way because of this law. Anyway, this second law says that a state that something will go is to its most probable state. And a good example of this, there's two other, well, let me mention that there are ways that you can get a more highly ordered state. It takes chance and time. And the other way is if you have an agent that does it. Now, evolution is this process. Okay? Of starting out here with random atoms, going to the next ordered state, and eventually you end up with a man. Funny looking guy. Okay? Now, the man is the final rung. Now, there are two ingredients to evolution, and don't ever mix these up either. They're totally independent. One of them are mutants. The second one is natural selection. And let me show you how they're related. When you go up, that's a mutant. These are the mutations that take you up. What natural selection does is you're going to have a lot more mutants going to chaos, according to the second law, and that's the way it works out in nature. Things just don't like to remain at a highly ordered state. They want to degenerate. Look at our bodies after we die. You know, they just want to go to randomness again, highly ordered. Natural selection just eliminates these. It does not help you get up to the next state. It just keeps you there once you get there. Okay? So they're totally independent. Mutants get you up there. Natural selection just keeps you up there. It doesn't help you get to the next state. It just keeps you from degenerating back down. Okay, but the problem here that this second law presents is not with natural selection. Natural selection is true. The problem it presents is with the mutants. And I want to show you why. I'll illustrate with a simple example first. Suppose you take 10 million watches, take them apart, and put them in a sack, and start shaking. Okay? What you want to do is have those 10 million watches fall together and come out running. Okay? Now, this is where it happens by chance. This upward process by chance. There's another way, like I said before, you can have it happen by chance or an agent. Now, if I took a little watchmaker and throw him in that sack, then he can do it as long as I keep feeding him food. Okay, now he can put it together, and those watches will all come out. But he is more complicated than the watches. Okay, so there's two ways to get up. Either by mutants, or, which are random, or it can happen by an agent. Okay, and the agent has to be more complicated than the state that it produces. This is just from the first law, second law again. Okay, now, the problem here is really with mutations. And I want to show you, some people say, well, man, it can happen given enough time. Well, that's one of the problems, is these two laws, as I've shown you, that finite time ago wasn't that awfully long ago. They say billions of years. I'm not convinced of that because every process in the universe is irreversibly one way and it's 100% inefficient, just about. We're going down at a fantastic rate, the universe is. There's nothing sustaining it at this level. And the more energy we had in the past, the faster it dropped off. That's why that curve drops off like that. It'll asymptotically, it'll die very slowly at the end, but at the first, it really dies fast. And it's dropping off. Now, when you come down here, the universe, you only have so much time to work with for this process of evolution to take place, if you're going to start with randomness. You still haven't solved the problem how the universe got all of its order in the first place. You still have to come back. But you remember that amount of time, the finite amount of time. Okay, you've got to get those mutants. Now, we worked out some calculations. A guy from Harvard and another guy from MIT and myself worked out some calculations on making some very simple assumptions on just to produce one DNA. Okay? Simple. Just a human DNA. It's one molecule. Very simple. And I want to illustrate a little bit how hard this is just by chance in the universe. How this hard this is to take place just to get one DNA molecule, much less one cell. That's astronomically harder. And let me illustrate by an example. Suppose George Bernard Shaw, who's an evolutionist, said, well, if you give a million monkeys long enough, they'll type a play of Shakespeare, you know, just randomly, which is essentially what's happening with a human being, coming about by random chances. By the way, I might mention here that this jump here, whether you take it in slow hops up or a single jump, it makes no difference. Your probability is the same. It's like flipping coins. It doesn't make any difference whether you want to get 10 heads in a row. It doesn't make any difference if you flip them one at a time or all at once. Your probabilities, because the product of each of these is just the same as the total here. Okay? Okay, now, Bernard Shaw said, man, if you had these million monkeys just typing away, they'd type a play of Shakespeare. Well, we worked out some probabilities, how long it would take those monkeys. So, I'll tell you what we did. Okay, we took the play of Othello. The first four words are four letters each. Okay, so the first four letters are one word. Now, mind you, these monkeys are typing at 160 words a minute. It's random. It's random, of course. But they're typing fast. And they're typing all the time, you know. They don't even observe the Sabbath. Okay, how long do you think it would take before the probability would become one that they type the first word? Take a shot. Yeah, that's when it will become a probable state. How long? Just take a shot. What? No. 30 seconds. Somewhere in there will be that first word. Somewhere. One of those sequences will be that. Okay. Let's take eight letters. Two words. Now, if they're typing it somewhere in the sequence, how long do you think it would take them? No. 10 minutes. Okay, let's jump up to 16 letters or four words. How long do you think it'd take them? Hour and a half? Someone make another guess. $280 billion years. That's a little bit of a jump. Okay? That's a little bit longer. The problem is, is the more complicated the system is, it goes up as the power, not as the multiplication of the thing. It goes up as the power. Okay? Now, we assume power, not as the multiplication of the thing. It goes up as the power. Okay? Now, we made some pretty, very liberal assumptions in our calculations. We assume, first of all, that one out of every two collisions, two atoms hitting, it was good, it was the right combination, they happened to stick together. Now, we know this isn't true. We got molecules hitting here all the time, and they don't come out with the right combination to form a DNA molecule. I mean, that's one out of two collisions of atoms anywhere in the universe, and they're good. Right combination. Let me write a couple of these down. Some of these won't impress you too much, but the final deal will. Okay? So you start out with one out of two. Two collisions is good. Okay? We assumed also that, well, they say that there are 10 to the 80th particles in the universe. We gave them 10 to the 1,000, which is a much bigger number, by the way. Yeah. 10 to the 80th is one with 80 zeros behind it. 10 to the 1,000 is one with 1,000 zeros behind it, which is a much bigger number. Okay? We assume that there were 10 to the 100th collisions per atom or per particle per year. And that's very generous, too. If you realize that there are probably about 10 to the 30th at most, that's an astronomically big number. That's called a Google. 10 to the 100th is a Google. Please. 10 to a Google is called a Googleplex. So when you hear the scientists splice around these words, you pick up a little bit of knowledge now, okay? Okay, so we gave them a Google of collisions per year. Okay? And this is the number of atoms in the universe. This is the number of collisions per year. And this is one out of every two. And we took human DNA, which has about 10 to the 10th atoms in it. Okay? Now what we're going to do is you're going to use the universe as a massive spark chamber. And we're going to precipitate DNA in some place in it. Now, do you know how long it would take for this to take place, to get DNA out of the universe? Take a guess.
30 seconds.
Now, just this is one DNA. The number of years, just to write this number, suppose I wrote one, and I wrote a zero every second, okay? It would take me 1,000 years to write the number. That's not even accounted. That's just to write the number. Yeah. And the universe, they say is only... the most conservative estimates... See, I just wrote that number while you're standing there. That's how long I think the universe has been around. My number, it would take 1,000 years writing it 1 zero a second just to write the number.
To get one DNA?
Yeah. To get one DNA. Now, this has built into it perfect natural selection. This has perfect natural selection. We're not assuming any degradation at all. Okay? If we were going to do it, we figured it out for a human being. To produce a human being, you need more than just one egg and one human DNA in it. You need actually a human being to carry the process on. We figured out what it would take for one human, and again, it's a big number. If you wrote 1000, and you could write a billion zeros a second, it would take you a trillion years to write them. So that shows you how many. That's just to write the number again.
How do you figure that out? That it takes a trillion years.
Well, you know how many you're doing a billion a second. Okay, you know how many seconds are in a year. You know, about 12 and a half million. Okay? Seconds in a year. And you know how many zeros you got to write, so you just divide it in, and that comes your years.
Oh, I see.
I knew you would.
That's really complicated, Linda. And so people will say, well, man, they say, we have these spark chambers where we spark those things across, and they've got amino acids in them. And we applied these same assumptions. We assume, though, that the volume is only about a cubic foot in a spark chamber. And amino acids have about 20 atoms in them. How long do you think it would take for this to form in a spark chamber? Under our same assumptions, one out of every two collisions is good. And that there, we assume many less collisions than this. I mean, we assume about what's right. But what would you say? You produce about a million a second. So they're parallel. They'll say, well, man, we produced it there. We can produce, the universe can produce a DNA. It can produce a human being. Baloney. The whole thing is, you apply the same assumptions to the spark chamber, and you should expect to get a million amino acids a second. So what? I mean, that's no great feat. That's by chance, and we're still producing it. You see the point here? It's when you apply these principles to a spark chamber, you should expect to get a million of them a second. But when you apply the same assumptions to the universe and much greater time, you can't even, it's impossible to produce it. Even with a big, the universe is a spark chamber. It's a real serious problem. However, this order could come about if there was an agent involved. And I would like to read to you again. These people, like I'm saying, are all against my position. What was the origin of life on this planet? Until recently times, there was a pretty general belief in the occurrence of spontaneous generation. This is where you got animals crawling out of the ground, you know, just... You know, it was supposed that lowly forms of life developed spontaneously, for instance, from putrefying meat. What, is that the right pronunciation? Yeah, I think so. I can't pronounce it. But careful experiments, notably those of Pasteur, showed that the conclusion was due to imperfect observation, and then it became an acceptable doctrine that life never arises except from life. In other words, you don't have things just crawling out of the ground. The eyes arise from eggs. The life always comes from former life. Okay? So far as actual evidence goes, this is still the only possible conclusion. But since it is a conclusion that leads back to a supernatural creative act, it is a conclusion that scientific men find impossible of acceptance. You see, the problem is, as you keep going back, life, you come to a problem. Where did the life come from? If it didn't come about by spontaneous generation. And they reject that. And that's why it has serious philosophical implications. It carries with it what are felt to be in the present mental climate undesirable philosophical implications, and it is opposed to the scientific desire for continuity. It produces an unaccountable breach in the chain of causation, and therefore cannot be admitted as a part of science unless it is quite impossible to reject it. For that reason, most scientific men prefer to believe that life arose in some way not yet understood from inorganic matter in accordance with the laws of chemistry and physics. This guy says it had to happen by the laws of chemistry and physics, and they back into the ring with the second law. And that's where the troubles really begin. It's really serious. Okay, we're going to have a session after this. I have a couple more things I want to bring out that are very critical. That scientifically, evolution cannot happen by chance. Now, this doesn't rule out theistic evolution, which I'm not an adherent of, but it doesn't rule it out. It doesn't rule out theistic, this means God's involved in the process, theistic catastrophism. Let me show you the difference between those on a graph a little bit. Suppose... uniformitarian, this is a, that's not the right way to spell it, but it's close. Okay, uniformitarian principle or evolution is a process by which things arose in a gradual descent with time. Catastrophism is one where things jump up in a step type of progression. You go along and all of a sudden it jumps up. You go along and jumps up. Creationism is that you have a jump all at once and it continues on. Now, if this were by chance, it would go up this way. This second law really eliminates that. Now, this doesn't say that God or someone else didn't carry this process on. In the other one, it says that it doesn't happen this way, by chance. But it doesn't say that God couldn't have done this. And this one, of course, would imply a big deal, that the things have always existed. When they came into being, they were all there. Okay, now there's a couple more implications that are very important. Everyone says, well, so what? You know, that's neat. That doesn't affect my life any. That's where they're wrong. Evolution might not, or the origin of the universe might not, but this law becomes very personal to each one of us, because it's the same law that says we die. It's the same one that the reason death is in the universe is because of this law. It's the end. We reduce back to the dust, where we have our existence at this high state of... In fact, we're so highly organized we can hardly begin to understand how it is, much less reproduce. And even if we do reproduce, I think we will. We theoretically, according to the second law, can produce another man, you know, a living man. We theoretically can. But that doesn't prove evolution, no more than the shaking of the sack produces evolution as opposed to the agent inside. Man is the agent. He's the one that's organizing. It's not by chance in that case. But this law becomes very important to each one of us. And this is one reason that it kind of really bothered my whole life. As I was telling one of the guys here, I come from a fairly wealthy family and the vice president of a big multi-million dollar company. And these guys, my dad's friends, they're fairly wealthy. My dad's not very old, but he's got a lot of these real wealthy fellas, friends, millionaires. And they'll come up and they'll say, well, Dave, man, I haven't seen you in a long time. You're about that tall when I last saw you. And I say, well, yeah, that's right. They're trying to get friendly because here's the guy that's supposed to be taking over this thing, and they want to, you know, how people are. They'll say, well, what have you been doing since I last saw you? Well, I went to MIT. And, oh, man, that's great, you know. You're really off to a good start. Well, what are you doing now? Well, I'm going to seminary. Oh. Like, couldn't you do anything better than that? And my reply, I got kind of tired of getting burned like that every time. So I kind of come back and I say, well, what are you spending your time on? What have you spent your life on? Of course, a businessman, he's not going to say money. That really sounds lowly, you know. They'll always come up with something. Well, the highest one they'll come up with is, well, I'm out to help mankind and further civilization and, you know, the great aspirations, you know. And I'll say, well, that's rather foolish. Some guy will look at me. And I'll say, because of this law of physics, well, I'll say, because of the second law of entropy, you know. The guy says, no, I don't know. And I say, well, according to this law, not only are you going to die, but even if you are a great man and we're able to build a great civilization, time, the second law, will eat it up. It'll return to dust. And even if you are able to transcend that, make your ideas universal so that they'd be carried on for all mankind's civilization, the civilization itself is going to die. The universe is going to die. Everything that you're pumping your life into is going to end up in nothing. And at the end, you have nothing, your works have nothing, and the civilization has nothing. It's worth nothing. This law really robs man of anything that's worthwhile. And I say, this is the reason I'm taking my time out to go to seminary. Not everyone will. But I want to, because only one man has come along and claimed to give people eternal life. This is the only way to beat this law. That's why that claim is so significant. Because everyone's robbed of anything worthwhile by the second law. Pleasure, what's pleasure? Time erases it. Money, time erases it. You can't take it with you. Anything is robbed. Nothing is eternal. And if that's why the claim is so... Some people say, well, you're going to live for that pie in the sky by and by. I'm worried about the chow here and now, you know. And that's what they said. That's what one guy told me. And I told him, well, okay, here you are at the present time, but tomorrow, today, will be yesterday, and tomorrow will be the present. You're always progressing in time, and someday death comes, then what? Then there's an ever-present eternity. And he says, well, what? I don't know that. One man has come back from the dead to tell us about this. Now, I've searched out this thing because the whole thing of Christianity centers not on its morals, as people think. It doesn't center on anything but the man of Christ and his claims. No man with any insanity at all has claimed that he's God. People say Christ didn't claim that. He most certainly did. They were going to stone him many times for it. That's why he was crucified, because he claimed to be God. And that's blasphemy to the Jews. Utter blasphemy. Secondly, he claimed to forgive people's sins. This doesn't seem to be very significant. Yet if I abuse someone else, how can a third guy forgive me for attacking this guy? And the Jews recognized that claim. They said only God can do that. And lastly, what man has claimed to beat the second law? Nothing else does. What man has claimed to give people eternal life? And man, that's important. It not only gives us a life hereafter, it gives us a life now. If I'm just burning up my time on these things, that just time just keeps wearing them down. We've got to keep working to make money. For what reason? To spend it, to lose it. The process is continually wearing us down. And eventually it catches our bodies. We grow up, we beat the second law for some time. We don't really beat it. We've got to keep eating food to keep our bodies up. But pretty soon it gets to our DNA. And our DNA can no longer build us up again. The second law gets to the DNA and we die. So a man's life is worth nothing apart from eternal life. And that's why the claims of Christ are so important, that he offers people absolutely free. I've been in the church a long time, and it really hacks me off. People think you're going to earn eternal life. I don't know where they got this idea. It's not from the scriptures. The worst man on the face of the earth. You remember the cross up the hey, did you guys see the movie Ben-Hur? It just came through Dallas again. Saw that thing. There was two guys put up, thieves on each side. And one of them said, he got mad at the other guy and said, why do you abuse this guy? We deserve to be up here. And this, he said, he turned to Christ and then he said, Jesus, remember me in your kingdom. And Christ said, today you'll be with me in paradise. Now what did that man do to deserve it? Not one cotton-picking thing, except he believed in Jesus Christ. He placed his faith and his destiny on Jesus Christ. Any man that places his destiny in the physical world dies with it. And then he has an eternal life. What God offers us in this life is a personal relationship with him. Death seals that, though. And all we do, we make the decision. God doesn't condemn us. We choose whether we want to be with God or not. Then we have eternity that way, separated or with him. And I, one closing comment, I got to studying the book of Revelation a little bit. And in there, it shows these guys sitting on these 24 elders, they call them, and these angels. All these guys do, they got crowns on, and they're dressed in white, and they throw those crowns down before God and say, holy, 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 Lord God Almighty. And I thought, man, what a drag. It says these guys do that day and night, forever and ever. And I thought, oh, none of that. I mean, wonder, man, if this bag was so good, this eternal life bit. Because you're stuck to that. I got to thinking about it. And in that, there must be something so great about God that it possesses people like that for eternity. Angels are supposed to be spiritual beings, but supposed to be more intelligent than we are. That men should be so awed by the presence of God that they do that for eternity. This had such an impact on a bunch of the guys on drugs down there that they just totally chucked it. They just said, man, what do drugs have to this personal relationship, and it's a daily thing that they have. Plus, I'm going to have that in eternity. Some people say, man, that's not worth it. There's something great about that's worth it. In this life, what does a man have to hope in? Nothing else. So I kind of got off on the end here. I want you to think about it, though. That what is your life worth? What is life about? Is it worth anything? Is it worth anything to you? God offers eternal life, and all you have to do is invite him in. When I was at MIT, I was going along my own happy course. My game was achieving. I liked to wrestling. I almost came down here to wrestle. I was a pretty fair wrestler in Kansas, and I worked real hard. I started off, I wasn't very good at first, but once you get good, and then you start winning, every time winning. But when you win, what do you have? You're really big getting above me. Last one, one evening, man, you're all gunned up. The next day, nothing. I would achieve in academics, and I did very well there. I get up and I get the deal. All you have to do is work harder than the next guy to beat him. It's not always a matter of intelligence. It's just a matter of how hard you want to work, and you can beat anybody. And so I would achieve this way, academically. It finally occurred to me after a lot of this achieving, when I got to MIT, is this all life's about? Achieving, then what? You've got to set up another goal to shoot at. Then what? Some other guys just give up. They can't hold up in the competition. They want to choose another route. And they begin, well, what am I going to do? Am I going to be a functional, going to have a functional wife with a functional house, with functional cars, functional kids, functioning in a job? Is that life what it's about? That's not much to it. Well, anyway, I just think about these things because you're living life and time's passing. And if you want to waste your time, fine. Waste eternity, too. It's very important, and it's very important now. I have an abundant life now. I'm not talking about the thing here. I can talk to God daily. He's concerned about me. I'm willing to trust my life with him. For instance, I don't know what I'm going to be doing next year. I may be a president of this big company, or I may be some scrub missionary down someplace. You know? I don't really get excited about that. but I might. But I've never missed. I had a great opportunity to be a doctor, to be a good scientist, to be a good businessman, any number of these things. And God got me in this other course. It's amazing. You don't feel this big thrust, man, you got to go this way, and he doesn't just cram you in a mold, you know, like that. He begins to bring you and develop you and change your life. And that's why one reason I'm so sold out. I'm convinced I wouldn't get up here and tell you, you knew me before. I wasn't about to get up before people and tell them something like this. I'm convinced of it. I've seen it work. I've seen other people's lives work. It'll work for you, too. But it's between you and God, and it's not between me and you or anyone else. It's a personal relationship. But I got down. I finally gave up. Okay, God, if you're really there, I want Christ to come in my heart and live. And I was very disappointed. Nothing really happened drastically. In fact, for a whole year, I began to wonder. I didn't have anything, an experience to point to or anything. Just begin to move and change. And that's about the heart of it.